My duty if I did not thank the committee for inviting myself and Grace, Grace and myself, to be with you at this lovely, lovely session by the sea. And it is so wonderful to see so many in this room that I dearly love. And it's good to see them sober again. Before I get started, I'd like to find out how many are here for their first sessions by the sea or for their first AA conference, roundup, or convention. Would you hold your hands up, please? My God. How many alcoholics are here in this hall that are sober 90 days or less? Would you hold your hands up? Welcome. I'm one of these Alcoholics Anonymous who believes that when we make an AA talk, that the only thing that we can share is our own personal stories, or as was read in chapter 5. But you know, there's something very interesting that was read just a moment ago. And it says that our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. And then it follows a line that says, if you have decided that you want what we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, and then you are ready to take certain steps. And this is all I know about being an alcoholic, is how I drank, and what happened to me. And the only recovery program that I know, and the only recovery life that I know today is Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank God I have not had the misfortune of having any other. And so this is all I know is this story. It was a Sunday, 27 years ago, the last Sunday of last month of August of 1950, that a group of fine sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous invited me to come to an AA birthday party at the old Suburban group there in Dallas. A lady who was my manicurist at the time said that she was going to celebrate 1 year sober in a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I asked her what was that. And she said she'd been sober a year, and I said, Edith, you're a liar. Nobody stays sober a year, maybe a day, maybe a week, maybe two, but nobody a year. She says, yes, we've got this deal, and I've been sober a year. We have this birthday party, and it's for those of our members of this group who have 1 year or more continuous sobriety, and we have a month of birthday party. Now, Edith, I knew I drank a lot of whiskey with Edith, and nobody could stay sober that long. But I noticed when I'd be more at myself and I'd go down that barbershop and I'd be halfway sober, I knew that something had happened to Edith. She had changed. I noticed that when she was giving me a manicure, she was buffing my nails instead of my knuckles. And she wasn't drawing blood with a cuticle pusher. She wasn't grabbing her purse and running into the ladies' room to quit smelling halfway between an Avon woman and a whiskey bottle. Now, Edith looked like a real drunk ought to look. She was a two-fisted drinker. She just looked like a drunk ought to look. She wasn't a very pretty girl physically in the face, and she had big pop eyes, and her nose was all over her face where she had fallen and been broken. She had gaps in her teeth. And Edith was quite a gal. You know, back in those days, gals used to wear, you know, pantyhose used to wear garter belts. And hers always trailed behind her uniform when she was drunk. She'd fall and drop all the bottles and everything. And along with the garter belts back in those days, the ladies used to wear holes and had seams up the back. You could always tell when Edith was drunk. The seams was in the front, the front was in the back. But I noticed that at my Edith had changed, and the change came about in a manner in which I was took many, many years to find out what it was. I noticed that her eyes changed. My, those beautiful eyes. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have two kinds of eyes. We have those beautiful, laughing, dancing, thankful, grateful, smiling eyes. And we have those sad eyes. And her eyes changed. And gosh, they were laughing and they were sparkling and they were dancing. And then she turned to another lady, also a manicurist in the same barbershop. Her name is Moena. And she said, now Moena here is my sponsor. And she has 15 months sober in this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew Moena was lying because I drank a lot of whiskey with Moena. And Moena says, yes, we would like for you and your wife to come to this birthday party. And I thought that the only reason that people such as you would invite someone such as me to come to one of your AA functions is that you needed to have some good-looking, outstanding, and successful professional man come and upgrade you kind of people in the community. And I was glad to come help you. So I went home and told my wife, and God, she was thrilled. Because people had long since quit asking us to come anywhere. And she used to say, why is it that we're not asked to come to outdoor barbecue parties anymore? Why is it that we're not asked to come to bridge parties? And I said, it's you. Every time we go someplace, you run in the kitchen and you holler at me, do you have to have another drink? Don't you attack him. You run to the host and don't give him another drink. Lock up all the whiskey. You're driving everybody crazy. And woman, if you don't shut up, you're going to be left alone. That when I think that I am drinking too much to embarrass you, I will slow down. And furthermore, I love you so much, we were asked not long ago to come, but knowing that you're sick, I told him that you were ill and that we could not come. And she said, almost cryingly, are we going to go? And I said, yes, if you will shut up. And so that Sunday morning, I got up at 5:30 to get dressed and get ready to go to an AA birthday party, 5:30 that afternoon. And I woke up and I did what all good self-respect and drinking drunks good. I started sucking on a quart of whiskey. Well, let's face it, you know, golfers golf, fishermen fish, and drunks drink. That's all it took. And when I drank a half quart of that whiskey, I knew that something was, I didn't know what was wrong, but I knew that I was going to have me a drink later on, so I put the other half a quart in the trunk of the car for my safety valve. And I started taking a shower and singing and, you know, and got dressed. And I put on the finest of clothes. And I put on everything that I thought that would impress you. And I put on a white on white monogram shirt, monogram handkerchief, monogram drawers. I put on my diamond ring, my diamond watch, and the trademark of every good self-respecting, high-rolling, drinking drunk. A brand new pair of custom-made alligator shoes. And I wish I'd saved the suit that I come to that meeting with over 27 years ago. It too was being styled. It had wide lapels. And I had a beautiful tailor-made beige suit with quarter-inch stitching. And I had a beautiful tie to go along with that thing. Now, I see enough old heads around here that we remember right after World War II, we wore ties as wide as these, except they were hand-painted. And I had a beautiful hand-painted beige tie to go along with that rig. When you tied the knot, there were two figures on it. Up at the knot, there was a sailfish sailing over the moon. And on the wide part was a Hawaiian hula girl with all of her personality characteristics showing. And I'd wear those that tie in the places I used to go, and it was quite a conversation piece and going out with a bunch of drunks. I thought that this was the appropriate attire. And I got dressed and I got out in the car at 10:30 in the morning and I honked and she said to me, what is it? And I said, let's go. She said, doesn't start for 6 more hours. So it started this business of looking for a drink, emptying out empty, straining cigarettes, looking here, draining spiders, looking for under the bushes, in the garbage, every place looking for a drink, took another shower, shaved again, run around the block. And finally at 4:30 I honked and let's go and we went. And we got into a Roadmaster Buick, looked like a funeral car, and off we went to the meeting. We got out to this place, and I made a move two cars to get this fine car in there because I wanted you to know that someone important was going to come to help you. And we got out, and as we went up to the steps to where the group met, there were two drunks sitting on the steps. And one of them got up, and he said something to me, and I hit him. I didn't want him to mess up my fine clothes and shoes. I parked him over here. And his buddy that was sitting over here onto my left, he took offense at what I had done to his friend. And he came after me, and I hit him, and I parked him over here. And I said, you two little boys be good, because I've got me some whiskey in the car. And after this meeting, as quick as it over with, us three will drink. And I went on inside, and I got in there, and it must have been about 80 members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and their families, and their children, and their poodles, and their parakeets, and everybody in there. And everybody talking, and smoking, and hugging, and kissing. And you know how it is when you get into a bunch of AAs, you come to a meeting, you know, you stand there talking to one, they'll just walk away from you. Or you're talking to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody will come in between you, they'll talk to you, talk to them, walk right on through, and everybody said hello. And everybody, and I looked around and I saw all those signs, you know, first thing for, I said, my God, I'm in a kindergarten, you know. And I saw what I saw then, yeah. And I still believe it's the most dangerous sign that you can put in an AA facility or an AA group, and that's the one that says think. Because it's dangerous for our kind of folks to think, drunk, sober, or dead. And if you don't believe it, you tie a little drunk on the head and tell him how good he's doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, and let him get over in the corner and start thinking for himself, and he'll get drunker than an $8 bill on you. And I saw a plot for the grace of God in my head drop. I didn't want any part of that, because I knew that drinking and God did not go along. They blew a whistle and everybody went into the AA meeting, and I went in and I sat on the back row because I wanted to look you people over and see what kind of help I could give you. And the first celebrant got up was a lady, and I darn near fell out of my chair. I knew her well. That is the lionest person I'd ever been around, and I drank a lot of whiskey with her. And there she said she was sober for 1 year and sane in her right mind, and I hollered out, liar. And somebody said, shut up. And she started talking about this miracle in her life and started talking about this miracle, 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 and I hollered out, tell it. And somebody said, shut up. And she says, as a result of the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, she caught Christ back in her life. And if anyone who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, unless they found Jesus Christ as their higher power or personal savior or power greater than themselves, there was no way in this world that they could stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said to myself, what a heck of a trick to pull on a Jew. That you invited me to this deal to convert you, that's what it was. And if this is what you were, I needed to drink bad. Now, I'm asked all the time, how come there are not any more Jews in Alcoholics Anonymous? And it's very simple. The way people have their noses fixed and their names changed, you don't know who you're sitting next to in the day. And you know, I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and many years to get sober. And we can compare ourselves right out of the door in Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody didn't do what we did when we drank. We're not an alcoholic. We didn't do this. We didn't do that. We're not an alcoholic, you know. And I come to this meeting many, many years later to get sober from this meeting. And everybody got up and said they come from a fine Christian home, you know, and they had a fine Christian education, and they had a fine Christian this and this, you know. And I didn't come from a fine Christian home, and I didn't have a so-called, as you would understand it, fine Christian education, you know. And they said they started drinking, you know, when they were 17 years of age, and I didn't start drinking when I was 17 years of age. Or they had their first drink. Some said they had their first drink in the service. I didn't. Some did that. And I felt, until someone straightened me out, but at the time, I thought that you had to compare yourself with another person did. Not how you feel about loneliness and desperation and darkness and inner blackness. This was not explained to me at first. And I thought it was what you did after you drank. That's why you identified yourself as an alcoholic. Not the reason that caused us to return to drinking because we couldn't stay sober. And I heard all these things and I said to myself, I must be in the wrong place. Because in the religion that I was born in, you hear it all the time that nobody will get you drunk and nobody will, you know, hold you and pour a drink down you. Well, in the religion that I was born, you know, on the eighth day, they name you and introduce you into the tribe. And it's done in a very unique manner. Now, the gentleman that performs this ceremony, in my case, he had a black hat, a long black beard, and a long white robe, and his tool in trade was a sharp little knife. Now, this gentleman is not licensed to perform surgery in the normal manner, you know, and so they do it in a very unique way. His helper is the godfather, and it's the godfather's job to get an old-fashioned ice tea glass, and he fills it full of 100-proof bourbon. And then he gets the water gauze, and he soaks it thoroughly in the bourbon. And then after it's soaked thoroughly in the bourbon, he places one hand over the baby's mouth and takes the gauze with the bourbon and walks it gently in front of the baby's nose and lets the baby inhale the fumes, and he goes to sleep. And right when that man with that little knife said, ready, and that's when that godfather opened up that mouth and put that alcohol and that gauze in my mouth, and that's when the first drink of alcohol was forced down, me against my will. And I've had one heck of a problem ever since. So you see, very humbly, long ago I had to give up something in order to get started this way of life. sitting in that back row when that woman talked about that, and my mind closed. And I didn't hear one word. Because you see, it was many years later that I found out what was happening to me at that meeting. And it wasn't until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous 17 years later to get sober. And they shoved a book in it. A book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And may I remind every alcoholic in this room, it is the only book in print with those two words on it. There is not another book just like it, better than, worse than, greater than, or anything else. If it's not it, it ain't it. And in it, they said, you read it, and everything in there, if this is what you can become, if you're willing to, and also be identified with the nature of the malady. And I read what was in the doctor's opinion. And in it, this little doctor wrote something that many, many years later, I had to find out what was wrong with me at that meeting. The little doctor wrote that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I couldn't blame her anymore. I couldn't blame you anymore. I couldn't blame the ethnic background or religion that I came from. I couldn't blame this, I couldn't blame that, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And although we will admit that it is elusive and injurious, there comes a time when we cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And then the alcoholic believes his life to be the only one. We're restless, irritable, and discontented. I never was restless and irritable and discontented when I was drinking. I was drunk. It's in between drunks that I was restless and irritable and discontented. We got drunk to get sober, to get drunk, to get sober, to get drunk, to get sober. It was in between drunks that I was restless, irritable, and discontented. Until we can again experience the ease and comfort which seems to come at once after taking a few drinks. Drinks that we see others taking with impunity. My wife used to say, why don't you drink like a man? I said, well, I'm drinking with both fists. What else do I want to do? She said, why don't you drink like Herman? I said, I don't want to drink like Herman. I don't even like Herman. She said, why don't you drink like Stanley? I said, well, get Stanley and his wife over the house on Saturday night. And I'd come over, and Stanley and his wife would come over, and I would be the bartender, and I would fix Stanley's drinks like I was drinking liquor. And an hour and a half later, after Stanley got there, he was passed out in the living room floor on his back. My foot would be on his navel. And I'd look at her, and I'd say, you want me to drink like that drunk slob? Needless to say, Stanley and his wife didn't want to come back, nor did they invite us around anymore. But once we succumb to the desire again, here is the thing that separates us from the so-called social drinker, normal drinker, or whatever kind of drinker. Once we drop that juice in us, may I remind every alcoholic in this room that we're the only people on the face of the earth, that when we drop that juice in us, there's something happens to us that happens to only our kind of people and to nobody else on the face of the earth. It sets up this phenomenon of craving for alcohol. My God, how my body craved alcohol. And this is what happened to me at that meeting. Because you see, I violated a very serious code in that living. I drank that half a quart, and I had that half a quart in the trunk, but I couldn't get out of that meeting. And then once it sets up this phenomenon of craving, once we start to drink, we go through the well-known spree, ending up remorseful and screaming to anybody that will listen to us, we'll never do it again. Yet we did it again and again and again and again and again. And here's where the little doctor, as a result of his working with alcoholics and later on watching our co-founder, who when he first asked him, do you mind if I would sit and talk to these alcoholics, they looked at him rather hesitatingly. And he says, until such a person undergoes an entire psychic change. And how do we undergo this psychic change in Alcoholics Anonymous? As a result of our ideals that are firmly grounded in a power greater than ourselves. But until such a person undergoes an entire psychic change, there is very little hope for his recovery. But once such a person undergoes this psychic change, a person who was doomed hopeless and helpless and had so many problems he could never be able to solve them, can now very easily control his desire to drink. The only thing being that it'd be necessary for him to follow a few simple rules. I didn't know this at the time, and this was what happened to me. Because in that meeting, I violated a very serious code. Because I started drinking with, working with, get drunk with, fighting with, sleeping with, cheating with the black and the white wino, which was then Skid Row. It's Skid Row today, and I guess it'll always be Skid Row in Dallas, Texas. And I'm not proud of a lot of the things that I'm going to share with you, nor am I sorry. That's the way it is. I am what I am.
And thank God my dark past in God's hands is the greatest asset that I have to gain. And I never did think in my life that how I drank and how I lived would ever be worth a tinker's dollar to another human being. And I've lived on three skid rows in my lifetime, one for over 6 years, one for over 4 years, but the last one for 14 months was the toughest. It was murder. And I learned a lot of things. I went down there as a youngster, 11 and a half years of age, didn't have to be down there, because I came from one of the finest families that God ever put on this earth. I was blessed with the most wonderful mother and father that any son could ever have. I had a mother and father that were both born in Europe, and although they were raised 28 miles from each other in Europe, they met in Dallas, Texas, and they were married. Both of them left Europe because of religious oppression, and they came to this country in order to worship a God of their understanding, and they fell in love with the United States. They fell in love with the freedom of rights and the Constitution as the citizens of this country, and above all, to be able to worship God as they dearly loved God, as they understood. And there were two sons that were born of that marriage. And my mother and father dedicated their lives to give to the two boys that were born of that marriage everything that was denied them when they were growing up. And if one is going to be an alcoholic, I don't know of a better deal when you've got a mother and father that is willing to bail you out of everything, out of jails, out of penitentiaries, out of goonie roofs, out of nut houses, out of sanitariums, out of hot checks, out of everything. And my father went to work and he became a tremendous financial success. He had a very simple farm bill. He bought something for $2 and sold it for $6. He never wrote a hot check. He never wrote a check that was insufficient. His word was his bond. Just because they had a sale, he didn't go down and buy something. Everything, he bought life insurance. He paid his taxes. He took a discount on every one of his utility bills. And it, even if he could walk to mail it, he would to save that stamp. And he was a man of his word and a beautiful man. And if I'd listened to my mother and father, by the time I was 40 years of age, I never would have had to work another day in my life. I've had enough money for all my great-great-grandchildren and most of y'all's great-great-grandchildren and a lot left over. And so I never fell out with my mother and father because they couldn't provide the love and they couldn't provide the understanding. I fell out with them when I got into jails and I got into institutions and some very serious troubles. And I'd either go to them before or getting out, one of the two. And I'd go to them, I'd look at my father, and my father look at my mother. Now, my mother ran the family. When she was 75 years of age, she was only 4'11" and a half, and she had a backhanded slap with her right and her left hand that was faster than any rattlesnake you've ever seen. My daddy was afraid of her. Her rabbi was afraid of her. Everybody's afraid of my mama. And she was a born, dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. And my mother would have gone to her grave absolutely believing that she never did anything wrong in her life, that she never told a lie, that she was absolutely perfect. 9 1/2 years before I got sober at Alcoholics Anonymous, my mother and father in religion, and they were born in and they died in, they dearly loved in, they lit the candles and said the prayers of the dead for 7 consecutive days. And on the 8th day, their son was no longer alive in their mind. He was dead as far as they're concerned, and that's the greatest thing that could ever happen to them. Because you see, as long as I could go to Daddy, Daddy look at Mama, Mama look at me, and says, well, Papa, he's a good boy, a little different from his brother, let him have it. I'd go to Daddy, Daddy go look at Mama, Mama say, let him have it, Papa, and I'd go and I'd take the money and I'd flee. And I did this unashamedly till I was 47 years of age. Yeah. I could have. And that's the greatest thing that ever happened to them. And they could get a good night's sleep and not worry about the phone when it rang or where he was. However, about 6 1/2 months before my mother passed away, one morning my brother called me and he says, Mother wants to see you. And I says, you know I can't go over there. He says, it's going to be at my house and you come in through the kitchen door, through the garage, and Mother will be in the kitchen and Daddy will see. And I went in there, and she knew that I was going, and I didn't know this at the time, but she knew I was going to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went in there, and she kissed me on my forehead and called me her son for the first time in over 9 years. And she said, you know, she said, unbeknownst to me, she had become an Al-Anon. And they had taken her a newcomer's packet home, somebody over here did. And she fell in love with the drunk. And she fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and the Big Book, and she started reading everything about Alcoholics Anonymous. Not about alcoholism, but about Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, you know, I want to make an amend to you. I believe that's what you call it. She used to call it AAA. And she says, I have to make an amend to you. I've been wrong, absolutely wrong about you. She says, because many a night I would look at Papa and I said, Papa, are you sure that when that boy was born, they delivered us the right baby? Then he doesn't fit the mold. But after seeing that you were not sorry and it wasn't that you were no good, you were suffering from an illness, that you as a human being or any other human being, no matter what we could do to you, with you, and for you, we could not keep you sober. And tell those people in Alcoholics Anonymous, thanks. But above all, she said, keep going to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she says, I know you're not supposed to stay sober for anybody else, and you're not supposed to be going to Alcoholics Anonymous for anyone else except yourself. But she said, if I have one wish, it's not for your father, and it's not for your brother, and it's not for your wife, and it's not for our grandchildren. She says, it's just for you to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous, because she says, I know that if you do, one day at a time, you can stay sober. And she says, and don't try to fool me, because I'll be up there looking down at you. And she's not going to meet. You're already 30 minutes late. And tell everybody hello. And I almost missed it, she said. And so I started working down in an area that I didn't have to be down there, but it gave me a chance to do, I don't know what it was. I had a friend whose father owned a business, and I went down there as a youngster, 11 and a half years of age, and I started drinking on a daily basis and started drinking bay rum and wine. And that was the standard fare. And as I grew older physically and I could get more money in my pocket later on, I could go from that bay rum and wine to Johnny Walker Black Label Scotch and never miss a lick. And Tom, I could come down from that good Black Label Jack Daniel down to Gypsy Rose and Thunderbird and never miss a lick. Because I don't know about anybody in here, I wasn't drinking it because of the price of it. I wasn't drinking it because of the smell of it. I wasn't drinking it because it'll make you a better dancer, better fighter, better lover, worse lover. I was drinking it because I liked what it did to me once it got in there. And I wanted to continue that life. I wanted to continue the effect. And I got into lots of trouble. I learned a lot of things down on Skid Row. Never get your back up against the back wall. Always have a back door or window you can jump out of. And when you start drinking that wine, and you get hung up in the corners. And I got picked up by many, many, many weekends and many, many nights by the police. Always, if you smoke a cigarette or eat anything, keep both hands free so you can hit and run. I've always been short. I was born 5'6". I'd drink that juice and I'd be 7 foot tall. I'd have thousands of fights, never one of one. My nose has been where my left ear is. My left ear has been where my navel is. My navel's been where my right ear is. I've been all rearranged, you know. I also learned never let a stranger put his arm around the back while I was sticking a knife in it. I learned all these things as a youngster, 11 and a half years of age. And when I was 16 years of age, I had the most wonderful opportunity as a youngster for 2 sevens. I ran off and joined Ringling's Brothers, Barnum Bailey. I was with bands. Now, for a youngster to go back with a circus back in 1936 in the summertime, would have been a thrill, because back in those days, the animals used to drag the wagons through the towns on the parades, and God, it was great. And all the aerialists and the clowns and the great clowns of the day, and gosh, all of the people with the fine circus, not me, it gave me a chance to drink. And I learned how to drink everything, and I learned one concoction I'm going to share with you. I look around here, and I don't see very many circus drinkers. I learned a beautiful thing called Green Lizard Circus Style. Oh, God, that's a great drink. That's elixir, sodium bromide, Lekkertiger hair tonic. And I used to drink that stuff, and I saw Bambi and those animals in Technicolor long before Walt Disney ever put them on the train. But I was trying to live three codes of living. Number one, I was trying to live a code of living my mother and father wanted me to live, because they had all the money, and if you're going to drink and get in and do the things that I do and get into the trouble, it takes money. And then I was trying to live the code of living that society demanded that I live, to go to school. And to become a useful human being and to be of service to my fellow man and a decent and useful citizen. And the third code of living that I was trying to live, and you know which one went out your way ahead of me, and that's to drink and do the things that went along with it. And so I violated a very serious code in that AA birthday meeting. I'm sitting on the back row, and this woman talked about Christ, and my mind closed, and I knew I had a half quart of whiskey in the trunk of that car. And I didn't have a back window, I didn't have a door to jump out, and I wanted to drink bad. But you see, on one side of me was my wife, on one, the other side of me was the lady who invited me to come to that birthday party. In front of me was the lady's sponsor who invited us to come, and to her left was the man who is my sponsor today. He was there at that meeting. And I hated everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. And every time I stood up to walk out that car to get that half quart of whiskey, it looked like 80 people stood up, turned around, looked at me, and said, "Sit down and shut up." And I hated you people. And after the meeting was over with and everybody went for the coffee and the cake and they started hugging and kissing and smoking again, I ran through them like a tornado. And I ran out to the trunk of that car and I got out that half quart of liquid gold. Now, I don't know about anybody in here, but I drank that half quart down in two swallows. Now, that's the way I drank liquor. I didn't put it in the brandy glass and run around and sniff it for 4.5 hours and burn candles and incense and listen to Lawrence Welk, you know. And I didn't put an inch in the glass and 7 inches of something else and straw and fruit and cherry and suck on it for about 2 hours. To me, that's sick drinking. I drank her to drop her down that hole where it'll do the most good and then put another one down there. And I've had a lot of them taste just good coming back up, just going down on myself. But let me tell you what happened when it dropped down in there. Oh, my God, that feeling, you know, where it goes all the way down to your toes and makes you turn at your toenails, you know. And it comes back up and it gets halfway between the ankles and the knee and the head says, "I wonder if it'll make it all the way up. I better drop another one down there to meet it," you know. And so the trick is when you're drinking is to have one going down and one coming up. Oh, God. And there is no way that you can explain that experience to a non-alcoholic. They wouldn't understand. But our message is to carry this to one who understands it. My recovery is only as good as the time that is elapsed since I last worked with a wet drunk. Roll that around your head a little bit. One who doesn't know that there's another way. Right one block away, laying out here in this water out here, thinking it's the only way to live in these motels and these hotels. Huh? Yeah. My recovery is only good as the times have elapsed since I worked with my last drunk. And I'll tell you what happened when I dropped that juice in there. My God, I quit perspiring. My hair laid down. My toes went back in those alligator shoes. And I looked down on the face of that Hawaiian hula girl, and she had the most beautiful, serene look I'd ever seen in my life. I ran past the two drunks on the steps, went right back in that group, got a hold of the oldest sober member that got sober in that group, and I got to arguing with him about the quality of y'all's fellowship. And he said something to me, and I hit him. And two of his babies got up, and we started a fight, and another one joined four of them, and we had a fight, and four of them picked me up, two on each side bodily, and threw me right out of that group. And I landed right out on the yard, and I was sailing through the air right over them drunks on the steps, and one of them said, "We don't need your kind here, and furthermore, you're too young to be an alcoholic." And I was 30 years of age at that time, and I wasn't going to tell anybody that I had been arrested numerous times for things that happened to me. Not just being drunk and doing the crazy things, but in a blackout, in jail, and my family not knowing where I was, and out in the street, down on Skid Row, and in flea-ridden hotels. And I stood, and they hurt my feelings. Number one, they tore my new suit, and they ripped the toes of my new alligator shoes. And I stood on that yard that Sunday evening, drunk and belligerent, with my fist clenched, screaming to anybody that would listen to me that I would never come back to this Christ soul-saving organization as long as I live. That I wasn't an alcoholic. I was too young to be an alcoholic. And the next 17 years after I left that meeting drunk and belligerent, with a closed mind, everything that could possibly happen to a human being happened to this human being. And the only three things that it never did happen to me, getting ready to get on a drunk, coming off a drunk, up to this minute, I never did willfully murder another human being, fall in love with another man, or die drunk, and that's the only thing. And so when I admit to you that I'm an alcoholic, I admit everything. And when I admit to you that I am a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to automatically admit to you that my life has become unmanageable, because if I could have managed my life, I could have managed my drinking no way. And I was recalled back into the service, and I didn't have to go back into the service. But it gave me a chance to get way away from my creditors that were beginning to nag and hound me. And two wonderful little boys were born to our marriage. And my wife started demanding little things, like she had to have money for baby shoes. and for formulas, and that gets in the way of a drunk when he's drinking. He's got to explain why the check's bounced. He's got to tell her, well, I just mailed it yesterday or 2 weeks ago. There must be some mistake. My marriage relationship didn't break down after I got sober. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it started deteriorating long, long, long ago. I was a stay-away-from-home kind of drunk. I'd be gone 6 weeks at a time, 3 months at a time, 9 months at a time. A lot of times my parents and my wife did not know or anyone else knew where I was. And one time I was gone for about 5 or 6 months. She had not heard from me. No one had heard from me. Didn't send any money home or anything else. I come running in the house with a 6 week growth of beard and the same clothes I'd had on for about 6 months. I smell like you know what. And I run in the house and I looked at her and I asked her this brilliant question. Did anybody call? And then I run up, I want to hug her and kiss her. After all, her long-lost husband's home. She said, get away from me. I don't want to have a thing to do with you. You're drunk, you're dirty, you smell bad, you haven't sent any money home. We don't love you anymore. Get away from me. And our kind are belligerent, and we can't take no for an answer. And incidentally, we can't handle a yes most of the time either, you know. And I'd run and I'd make another pass at her, and she said, I said, get away from me. I don't want to have a thing to do with you. And I look at her stunned. And I'd grab that long neck whiskey bottle, I'd go in the living room, and I'd get my favorite drinking glass, which was an 8 ounce peanut butter jar. Now that's a respectable drink. And I'd already be drunk, and I'd squash in about 5 ounces. And I'd drink it down, and I'd put my left hand over my left eye, and close my left eye, and keep the right eye steady. And I'd sit in that chair, and I'd glare at her and mumble. And I'd catch her profile when she'd come from the kitchen into the dining room, into the bedroom to check on the two little boys, and I'd say, my God, what's going to happen to me next? Here she is. She's not even but 26 and a half years old, and she's already going through the early change of life. You know? Of all the things that had to happen to me, it's just my luck to have married a frigid woman. And if this be the case, I'm going out and I'm going to find me the woman that'll understand me. So I grabbed my long neck whiskey bottle and I went out in the world and I started looking for the woman that would understand me. I looked all over the world for the woman that would understand me. And after I was sober 3 and a half weeks in Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked in the kitchen and there she was. She'd been there all along. Raising the children and lying to the creditors and hoping, well, maybe there's a $20 bill he'd overlooked. Maybe there was an insurance policy that someone had managed to capture from him before he cashed it in. But the thing that was driving she and the children and everyone that loved me the most totally stark raving that here she saw the man that she married and loved with every fiber of her being, totally disintegrating himself in front of her eyes. She was helpless and powerless to do anything about it. I looked all over the world for people that would understand me. I never could find them. You know, no wonder you were all in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in and said, we understand you. That shot that balloon right out of the end. Yeah. Huh. And so I was a call back in the service and gave me a chance to get way away from all those pressures. I was called back as a naval dental officer and I was attached to Marine Combat Unit, division rather. And for things that I had done while I drank, these things happened to me. There are more people come to Alcoholics Anonymous and say, I never did get in the penitentiary, and I didn't get a DWI, and I didn't lose my family, and I didn't lose my sanity. I didn't lose my self-respect. I just can't stay sober. I must not be an alcoholic. That's not the identity of an alcoholic. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we believe that an alcoholic, our description of an alcoholic, we believe he suffers from a twofold illness of mind and body. The mental obsession and physical allergy are compulsion to drink. Now, we hear it all the time in Alcoholics Anonymous. We try to explain it to everybody what this allergy is. Medical science can't tell you what the allergy is. Psychiatrists can't tell you what the allergy is. The men of the cloth can't tell you what the allergy is, but you give a drunk a little time and you'll figure it out. And it's simple. Many of us miss it. And here it comes, the allergy. When an alcoholic drinks alcohol and becomes allergic to being sober, that's the allergy. And if it gets any more complicated than that, I got to go to another room. But we suffer from an illness of mind and body. Now, there's three things that every alcoholic in this room, or room just like it all over the world, has done, is doing, or will do if he drinks. And this is where we are all the same in each and every respect, 100%. Number one, living a lifestyle on our own, the inability to keep from taking that first drink. We have no mental defense against it. Fully realizing what happens to us each and every time we take a drink, yet we'll never do it again. This time it'll never burn us as bad, and yet it burns us worse. The second thing that's equal to each and every one of us, living a lifestyle on our own, once we drop that juice in us, the inability to put that bottle down, walk away from it, and stay sober the rest of our lives on our own without Alcoholics Anonymous. And the third thing that's equal to each and every one of us in this room is that when we drank, we got drunk. And that's the nature of the malady. AA has two of the most beautiful descriptions of the alcoholic that I have ever read. One in chapter 3 and one in 4. In chapter 3, we are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. In chapter 4, the one that I like the most, it says to me that if when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking, you have little control over the amount that you take. And AA is very gentle with us and says, then you are probably alcoholic. Or I like the first step better than anything. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, physical, that our lives have become unmanageable, mental. I like that. Yeah, mind and body. And so our recovery is what in Alcoholics Anonymous, a spiritual recovery. We have come to find out as a result of those who started Alcoholics Anonymous, the founders, co-founders of AA, and everybody, and may I remind everybody in this room that we're the results of what was in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Good, bad, or indifferent. Good, bad, or indifferent. And so consequently, what our co-founders found that after they had exhausted all human aid, as read in chapter 5, a portion of it, came to three pertinent ideas, A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, that God could and would if he were sought. That we had an illness that was beyond human aid. And I had many, many years to drink before I found you people. And I got over there in the Far East and I got in a lot of trouble and they made the mistake of making me a club officer's officer. Slot machines and everything else, you know. And when I come to, I found myself totally incarcerated in the military prison. And when I totally come to, I found that I had a leg iron locked around my right leg and a chain welded leg iron, and the other end of the chain welded to a steel cot, and the steel legs of the steel cot immersed in concrete, and there are armed Marines around me 24 hours a day with M1 rifles, 6 bayonets, and sidearms carrying me to move. And when I totally come to, I found out I was facing 25 years in the federal penitentiary for the things that I had done, the loss of my franchise as a citizen, and naturally the loss of my license to practice. Do you think that worries me? Yeah. I'll tell you right now, it's not easy to get alcohol when one is totally incarcerated. But when this alcoholic wanted it, it did it. It wasn't easy. And the old delusion and delusion of the mind started once again, and because of my father's influence and because of the other things that I could get out of them, and by lying and cheating and using other people. They moved me over to the interior of Japan for the trial, and I know, I'll tell you now, they had me dead to rights. And it was a nasty and a mean trial, and they started bringing out things that I didn't realize whatever happened to me. And they went out for the verdict, and they came back and they asked that I stand before and get the message. You know what's worse than getting the message? Waiting to hear it. And when I stood there, what seemed like 2 hours, actually it was just about a minute, the convening officer of that court martial board said to the finding of this court that you're guilty, and they started reading off all the things that they were going to do to me, and they did to me, but because of my lying and cheating and involving other people, and incidentally, one took his life as a result of it, a fine career officer in the Marine Corps. Three were dismissed career officers as a result of their involvement with me.
It was over where the convening officer said, now, this has to go to two judge advocates, one in the Navy and one in the Marine Corps. But I'll get over the corner, I want to talk to you. And I went over there and he said, you can have liberty, but we're in a restricted area. And you haven't had only a uniform in a year. And you can go out to this little town, he said, but if I were you, I wouldn't get drunk anymore. Now, he never should have told me that. After all, being totally incarcerated almost a year, I deserve to drink. I deserve the good times.
And I put on that uniform and I went out of this little town in Japan, and this is the nature of the malady as I understand it. I had one drink of alcohol, and 3.5 weeks later, when I come to, I had a cuff on the right wrist, cuff on the left wrist, and chain in between. A cuff on the right ankle and a cuff on the left ankle and a chain in between, and two chains connecting the two chains, and a chain rather connecting the two chains, and some yo-yo hit me on the shoulder and says, "Move out, buddy." And I said, "You can't do this to me." And the next thing I know, I'm aboard a helicopter, and the next thing I'm aboard a military transport, and the next thing I know, I'm right back in that same prison compound, same cell, same cop, same leg iron on the same right leg. And the sergeant of the guard and the duty officer of the day had nerve enough to stick both of their ugly faces in mine and ask me, "What happened?" And I had no sense. And the Marine Corps was discussing me, who sent me back to the Navy, who sent me back to the United States. It's amazing thing about this alcoholic, and I imagine a lot of alcoholics, but I cannot tell you about this one. I never worried about my wife, my children, my patients, my mother, my father, my banker, my lawyer, my pets, my parks, my everything else, getting ready to get on a drunk on the road, coming off of a drunk. I wonder what they know. Where have they been? What have they done? I ain't sent any money home in over 3.5 years, and they didn't know where I was, and I started looking for place. My mind was just screwed up. I couldn't find her. I finally figured out, well, maybe she was in Denver. And so I called Denver, and a lady voice got on the phone, and I said, "Grace." She says, "No." I said, "Who are you?" She says, "I'm the babysitter." I said, "Well, where is my wife?" She says, "Why, she has a date, and she's on a weekend party in the mountains." And I said, "How dare she?" I said, "What's the number? I want to call her." She says, "Upon the advice of her lawyer, you're not to have any direct or indirect contact with her at this time." I said, "Well, where are the two boys?" She says, "They're playing across the street in the schoolyard." I said, "Go get them. I want to talk to them. I haven't seen them. I'm their father in over 3.5 years. She says, "I'm sorry. Upon the advice of the same lawyer, you're not to have any direct or indirect contact with your children at this time." And she hung up. And when she hung up, I said what every good, self-respected drinking drunk says: when the people that he knows that'll never let you down in a crisis, that'll stay with you through hurricanes, typhoons, snake bites, and hailstorms, let you down. I said these well-famous words: now that's gratitude for you. Here I am, a returning hero, you know. Because when the plane went in from the Far East and stopped in Midway Island, I ran into ship service and I bought 3 more rows of ribbons. And when I reached Travis Air Force Base, I had more rows of ribbons on my uniform than Eisenhower. Because after all, I was going to see my 2 little boys. And every mother and father and grandmother and grandfather and uncle and aunt want their children to believe they're the greatest people in the world. And every little boy and every little girl wants to believe that their mother and father and their older brother and their older sister and their favorite aunt and uncle and their grandparents are the greatest people in the world. And I knew my 2 little boys were going to look at me and say, "Daddy, you in combat over there." And I wasn't going to tell them that I violated every act against God, man, the United States government, the United States Navy, the United States Marine Corps. And I wasn't going to tell them that I was charged with every article in the court-martial manual except one, and that's treason. And I'll tell you right now, when you're locked up, totally incarcerated in military prison during wartime, and it's your own side, that's degraded, you know. You don't go around bragging about it. No, I wasn't going to do it. And so I'll get next to what this self-respecting drinking drunk has done, and I suspect many of us. I went down to my room and got me a fifth of whiskey, and I got a pencil and a paper, and I wrote a letter. "Dear Grace, if you'll just take me back, I promise you I'll never take another drink of alcohol as long as I live, and put a period, 4 ounces in drinking." You see, I put a condition on staying sober. I didn't write a grace. There's come a time in my life where alcohol has to be totally eliminated if I am to live as a human being. I have to find a lifestyle where total abstinence, no alcohol. Even if it means that you and I will never be able to live again as husband and wife, even if it means that I never will be a father to those 2 boys, even if it means I can never have a profession, even if it means I am unemployable, even if it means I am not a citizen of this country or anywhere else, there's come a time where I have to stay sober regardless of any condition, thing, people, or anything. No, I didn't. I put a condition on staying sober. If you'll just take me back, I promise you I'll never take another drink. And I drank and I sang and I wrote and I drank and I sang and I took it over to San Francisco to mail it. And 2.5 weeks later, the shore patrol found me half dressed, half undressed, half up, half down, a flight of stairs on the Embarcadero in a Skid Row hotel, and a letter still in my pocket.
The Navy was discussing with me to cut my artist release for 48 hours, and that's how I got out of service. I finally saw Grayson taking me back, and we started moving around. Started moving around. We moved 24 times before we come to Alcoholics Anonymous. Sometimes fast, sometimes slow, sometimes at midnight, sometimes at 5 in the morning, sometimes with the sheriff, sometimes without, and just moving. And we decided we were going to move out to West Texas and raise our two boys in a Christian environment. And I don't know, Willie knows what I'm talking about. I don't know about you folks, but a little town in West Texas with a Christian environment, that's a town of 3,500 folks that vote dry and drink wet. And the two most popular people in the town are the preachers and the bootleggers. You know. And so we decided to move out there, and I was a daily drinker, and I drank the other day. And I got up to where I weighed 260 pounds, and my blood pressure was so high that every time I pulse would beat, my hair would stand straight up, pumped like an oil well. And one day I wasn't feeling good, so I went to another little town towards Amarillo, Texas, and I went in there and I went to see my doctor. And old George looked at me and said, "My God, David, you look sick." I said, "I don't feel good. I come up here for an examination." He said, "Well, let's have a drink." And he poured me a shot of old something, and he took a shot of old something, and then he put the cuff on there and ran the air up, and he cut the air off and said, "My God, David, as high as your blood pressure is, it's a miracle that you're alive." I said, "What's wrong with me?" He said, "Your problem is you're too fat. You need to lose weight." And knowing that you're a compulsive eater, didn't say anything about drinking alcohol at all. He says, "I'm going to have to give you some help." And he wrote me a prescription for 60 of the most beautiful capsules that you have ever seen in your life, and then you're done. And he says, "Now, I haven't filled and taken like it is." So I went back home to this little town I was living in, got it filled, went home to lose weight and stay drunk. When I got home, it says, "Take one 3 times a day." Well, any good self-respecting drinking drunk knows that one's good, two's better, three's richer. So I took 3 and drank some whiskey. Wasn't losing no weight. Took 3 more and drank some whiskey, ran in the bathroom, looked in the mirror, wasn't losing any weight. Took a handful and drank some more whiskey. You know, Bill, our co-founder, wrote some beautiful lines when he said, "When an alcoholic is drinking, it's time out of mind. Time passes so slow." And the only sad thing that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous, that time passes so fast sober. Where does it go? And I was running in there, and I was grabbing those pills, and I was drinking that whiskey, and I took all the pills and drank all the whiskey I knew, and the next thing I knew, I was out in my backyard, and I was picking peaches off of rose bushes. I don't mind telling you. And they tell me I ran around that little town of 3,500 for 2 days, talking in the unknown tongue, you know. And being one of 2 Jewish families in 5 counties around, they gathered everybody in to see and hear the miracle. Because word spread like wildfire, the Jew had taught the Holy Spirit. And when I come to and I found out what I did, I says, "My God, those pills are messing up my drinking, you know." Oh, I've been to the psychiatrist and all the questions he asked me, my wife used to ask me for nothing, every one of you, you know. And long about this time, I called up my father. I said, "Daddy, if you will give me all the money now, that you're going to leave me when you die, at least while you're alive, you can watch me spend it and help me enjoy it." And he took a heck of a damn view of that, I don't mind telling you. I was getting it from him every week and it was killing him. Oh, the new thing, you know, the new usual thing, a new dentist comes to town. The lady that's working for me, she moves over with it. All the patients move over with him. And once again, just me and my bottle. No, I didn't lose 5 dental practices as a result of my drinking. And I didn't lose my family as a result of my drinking. And I didn't lose my self-respect, my money, and my sanity because of my drinking. You have to get sober in order to look back and see where you've been. Sober, I realized I lost all those things because I could not stay sober. I lost all because I couldn't stay sober. There are many, many people who drink, but not alcoholics, who don't lose 5 dental practices. They don't lose their sanity, their self-respect. But an alcoholic, I found, loses these things because he can't keep sober and become a useful human being unless he's got a lifestyle that motivates him. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we have this unlimited power. In AA, we call it God. That's what was read in chapter 5. Unashamedly. Not the God, your God, my God, but our Father. In AA, it's called the oneness of one, the common problem, common solution, common recovery, common Father, the oneness of one. You see, I have still many more years to drink. Not many more, but quite a few. But I lost all the things because I couldn't stay sober. We finally moved back. Grace had to go to work. As you heard her this morning, in a place that she hated with every fiber of her being. And it caused the most hellacious 14 months that I ever dragged in my life. I ended up back down on Skid Row in those 35 and 40 cent a night hotel rooms with a shoe tied around your neck. I tried to kill myself two times last year. I drank because everything near and dear was gone. I couldn't kill myself and I couldn't stay alive. I ended up in jail both times each time I tried to kill myself. And Grace didn't know where I was. My family didn't know where I was yet. All in the world she had to do was look out the west office window of her office. And she'd see a little wine hole fall out of a wine hotel because I got down to where all I had was a pair of thermal underwear. An old pair of gray flannel pants with all of my possessions in the pocket. An old gray sweater with the elbows out of the elbows. And no socks, but I still hadn't quite lost everything yet. I had an old pair of beat-up alligator shoes. And I know that area just like the back and the front of both of my hands. I started down there as a youngster, 11 and a half years of age. And I was looking for Grace. The only woman that I ever loved in my life and the only thing that was so good and clean and decent. And I couldn't be a part of that kind of living or could I? And I'd crawl into those docks and those 18-wheeler trucks and those refrigerated rigs and I'd look for her. And I'd want to walk up to her and tell her I'm sorry for all the things that I've done. I didn't go home very much. I stayed away. And one time I decided to go home. Maybe I could be a part of that kind of life and marriage again. And I had the drink to go home. And I went home and I looked at her and she looked at me and she says, David, do you have to drink and do the things that you're doing? And I guess it's the only time I ever told her the truth. I said, yes, I have to drink. I can't stop drinking. I said, Grace, why don't you find another man that will be a husband to you and a father to those two boys? I cannot function in that area. And she was getting stronger and I was getting sicker. And I grabbed my wine bottle and turned out and stumbled off into the utter blackness once again. And somewhere along the line on April 18th, 19th, of 67, I really can't tell you, I found the handwriting on the floor of the Dallas County Jail. Not the first time I've been in that jail. I've been in lots of jails. And incidentally, being in jail is not a requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. The last time I was in that jail, as I was being released, the sheriff who was alive then asked that I be brought before him. He looked at me and he says, David, if you ever show up in my jail again for drinking or drunk, I'm going to have you put away to where you'll never bother another human being, bird, tree, dog, or rock. You understand? I says, yes, sir, Mr. Bill. He says, you can go. And I heard him so well, I walked right out of his office, right down the steps, right into a whiskey store, got me a fifth of muskadoodle and got out in the park with the rest of the pigeons and the winos and grinned, and I beat him again. And this time I found myself once again on the floor of the Dallas County Jail. But by this time, I got to the point in my life where I couldn't stay sober and I couldn't stay drunk. I couldn't stay awake and I couldn't sleep. I couldn't kill myself and I couldn't stay alive. I couldn't eat and I wanted to eat. Couldn't work, wanted to work. Couldn't. Total saturation, highest center. It's a hellish existence. By this time, I'd run out of people. I'd run out of money. I'd run out of whiskey. I got down to me. And me couldn't stay sober. And me couldn't stay drunk. And me couldn't stay alive. And me couldn't kill myself. And me didn't want me as me was, but me's going with me every place me went. And I screamed out, my God, what I believe I had to scream out. I said, my God, is there any help for me? And something within me said, listen, you overeducated, egotistical, and pompous, and spoiled little drunk. Until you stop drinking, nobody can help you. Not even me. Which is meant to me then and means to me right this minute that I was the one that had to have the desire to stop and say stop. And as I look back now sober, I realize when I screamed out for help, that there not only was a God for me then, but help for me then because I'm still here. And that's as simple as I have to keep it. They called my name as the drunk that fell down, and how I got by that old sheriff, I don't know. And I started stumbling out to what used to be an old office of mine, and the lady who had worked for me was there to get some of the mail. And I stumbled through there and she looked at me and says, my God, doctor, you look sick. And I says, I am. I'm sick in the head and sick in the gut, just like the double blank on the domino, double nothing. And I was held together by just a human shell. I said, would you dial a number for me? You see, 27 years ago, a group of fine sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous could see in me what I could not see in myself. And after I'd exhausted all alternatives to me, AA, AA kept saying, inside, call AA. And I said, would you dial a number for me? I didn't know where Edith was, the gal who invited me to come to that birthday party. After I got sober, I found out she passed away sober. I knew that Molina had moved away, and I didn't know where she was, and she celebrated her 28th consecutive sobriety birthday. This past May, I see her every once in Wednesday morning. She's from Memphis. Yeah. The man who was my sponsor today, I heard that he had gotten drunk after 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I called him up, I didn't know if he was A&M or A&P, you know. And I asked her to call this number, and I said, my eyes are too soft to read it. But she got this man on the phone, and I said, W.O., he says, who are you? And I told him, he says, what do you want? I says, are you still interested in Alcoholics Anonymous? He says, yes, I am. Then he said, who is it for? And I said, it's for me. He said, well, we have a meeting tomorrow night. Let's just go and get it over with and go to take a drink of alcohol this day and call me tomorrow. And that's all he said. And after coming to you people and hearing this word, sharing love and share, I wondered where it was that morning when I called him. But you see, that man knows me as well as any human alive. And he knew that when I called him, I in the next 24 hours, and the hardest 24 hours I ever spent in my life. I never sobered up in the gloomy roof, you know. If I had a headache, I took a drink. If I didn't have a headache, I took a drink. If I wanted to go to the bathroom, I took a drink. Didn't want to go. If I wanted to go to work, I took a drink. Didn't want to go, you know. And I just, after 37 years of drinking, you know, cold turkey. Well, it's more like frozen buzzards, that's what it is. That's where you, something you don't hear very much anymore, where you walk and shake out a drunk, and you beat your head up on the wall. And I'll tell you one thing, when I come to the next morning, I was sober. And I didn't have a belly full of tranquilizers, nor did I have a prescription for 500 more, and for this I am so thankful. Well, it's more like a, you see. Sobering up that way is like an unnatural childbirth. You know, I'm like a natural childbirth, you understand? No anesthetic. It hurts like hell, but you sure got a wide awake baby. I don't mind telling you. And at 7:30, I called him again. I said, W.O., where's that meeting? He says, don't you take a drink of alcohol this day. And called me at 3:30. And it started that walking and that beating up against the wall and that sweating and that jumping. And finally at 3:30, I called him again. I said, W.O., where's that meeting? He says, do you really want to come to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? By this time, I was willing to crawl through 6 foot of snow naked just to see what kind of people you were that had this insatiable desire not to drink alcohol. And being the arrogance of a drunk, and I'm about as humble as Hitler anyway, you know. I said, if you'll just show me where it is and tell me, I'll get there under my own feet. He says, okay, I'll tell you where it is. And when you turn the corner, there's a whiskey store on the left, a beer parlor on the right. Don't you stop and buy and consume any alcohol, because when I get up there, David, I'm going to smell you, and David, I'm going to search you, and David, if you're drinking or drunk, I'm going to throw you right through the front door. You, David, cannot come to Alcoholics Anonymous drinking or drunk. And right there and then, he instilled in me that members of Alcoholics Anonymous were sober. Did y'all know that? But you see, I was in a serious predicament. Somewhere between the jail and using that phone and walking out that drunk, I lost my thermal underwear and I lost my belt. And if you drank wine like I did, you'll understand that. And then I'd heard that Grace had thrown out all of my clothes. And you know, when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous in that rig that I just got telling you about, and the only earthly possessions you have is a solid quarter and a nickel, and that's all that's left from the last blood that you sold at the blood bank to get wine, you're not doing too good. And so I called her up and I said, Grace, and she said, who is this? She hadn't heard from me in about 8-9 months. And I said, me. She said, who's me? I said, David. She said, oh. And then she said, what do you want? I said, Grace, do you happen to have one of my old suits? And she says, yes, I have one, and it's to bury you in. As I look back now, I then ask her the most foolish question I ever asked in my life. I said, do you mind if I borrow it for a little while? I said, I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. She said, it's another one of your lies and hunger. And the house where it was only 4.5 blocks from the phone, it just took me 3 years, or no, it took me 16 months to get from that phone the 4 blocks to the house. And I went home. I put on that suit and at the store and it fell. My youngest son was at home. And the oldest was away. I never educated my 2 sons at all. Now, there was no instant joy when I come home and announced I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous. They looked at me more like a leper as stood at distance. They'd write a note and put it over here, and I'd have to go get it, and I'd have to answer it, and she'd spray every place I'd go.
in and out of the bathroom, in and out of the closet, in and out of the dresser drawer. I'd sit down on the chair, get sprayed, before I sat down and after I got up. And I got dressed and I put on this suit, and I bid them goodbye. And I got into a Mustang that the bank was looking to repossess it, but they couldn't recognize because it looked like an accordion. And off I went to the meeting. And I went out there, it's on a Friday night. And I walked through there, and it looked like the same people that were there 17 years prior to the birthday party. We're all there grinning and smoking cigarettes and saying, "We knew this would happen to you." And I come in, and I hope I never forget the greeting that I got, because there's a gentleman there that stands to go and greet all the newcomers. And I hope I never forget that handshake as long as I live. His hand was dry and mine was wet. And I grabbed it and mine slipped away. And I believe that's how we slip away from Alcoholics Anonymous, for getting wet again. And now I'm going to tell you about the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. Every member of Alcoholics Anonymous hears it at one time, but I believe we need to hear it over and over and over and over and over again. And I believe if we go to meetings over and over and over again, we will hear this most beautiful AA message that is the greatest AA talk I've ever heard. And I've been privileged to hear our co-founder Bill and many, many fine talkers in Alcoholics Anonymous. This man then said to me, "Welcome, come in, sit down and have a cup of coffee. And let's talk about it. We understand exactly how you feel." That is the greatest AA talk I've ever heard in my life. A sober member of Alcoholics. A sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with his old firm dry hand and that beautiful smile in his eye, and a sick, stinking, shaking drunk he thought life was over with. Who it hadn't been long before he thought he was helpless, hopeless, and useless, and condemned himself in his own mind to drink to death, drink himself to death. Hanging on, one drunk talking to another. Alcoholics Anonymous was, is, and will always be the transmission of communication of one alcoholic to another. And right there and then, he didn't know it, but he instilled in me the feeling that there's no situation too difficult, or no unhappiness too great that cannot be overcome. And here comes up, yo, and he grabbed me by that suit and the left sleeve come off. And he drugged me in the men's room, he starts searching me, and he's smelling me, and he says, "Go." And I did, and he says, "You're clean, you can go in there." And meanwhile, we're stressed like wildfire. We not only got a new drunk in the group, he's a doctor. We kill more doctors and professional people in Alcoholics Anonymous before we get good and sober than any fellowship in this world. We got a doctor in the group. My God, look at the high-class people we're getting in. We're getting those hard-to-reach kind of people. Why, we're going to get psychiatrists, we're going to get judges, and we might even get the President of the United States. Won't the First Lady make one heck of an Al-Anon, you know? We're going to upgrade Alcoholics Anonymous by getting these hard-to-reach, high-class folks. How can you upgrade God? I believe that the only way that we can upgrade the quality of the recovery program in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is to stay sober, unencumbered, and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. And I'll tell you what this man said then to me, and I walked in, he's a doctor, and you know, they don't know whether you're an MD, PhD, veterinarian, VBS, or whatever you are. And I'm standing there, and I'm going to tell this story because I was asked to tell it, and I was going to tell it anyway. And I feel the tug of the coat before I said, "Doctor." And I turn around, goofy looking little woman, she looks like she's on something, you know, and I said, "Yes." And she says, "Doctor." And I said, "Yes." And I'm there with that one sleeve coat. She says, "Doctor, I've got a problem." And I said, "Yes." And she says, "My right ovary is bothering me." Well, before I could explain to her, you know, I was a dentist, I wasn't a physician. She says, "Is it all right if I take Valium and B12? You know. Well, you know, being an idiot and a professional man, I straighten and I dust myself off with the one coat sleeve, you know, suit. I look at it professionally and I say, "Well, honey, if the roots of your teeth are that long, take them, you know." And here comes up, yo, and he grabs me by the right sleeve, and it rips, you know. And he says, "Okay, wise guy, the show's over with." "I'm thankful that you called me." And he took me in and introduced me to another member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We sat down, and he starts talking to me about what it used to be like with him and what happened and how it is today. And it started a way of life that's ended. You know, we are normally people who would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding that's indescribably wonderful. You know, when I come to you people, you know, and for the first few months in 45 days, it wasn't much fun, but I wasn't drinking. And I'm for firm and strong sponsorship, and they started in on me. And they said, while you're not doing anything, you sit down and you start writing about you. And on my 43rd day of sobriety, my sponsor called me up and he says, you're going to be down at my office the next morning at 8 o'clock. And I said, what for? He says, you're going to take the fifth step with me. I said, that's too early. People say, you got to wait a while in Alcoholics Anonymous. You got to be sober at least a year, 2 years, 3 years. Take it cafeteria style. He says, you ain't been in a cafeteria so long they don't have them on Skid Row. You won't know what it is. We'll count with one. And he said, you're too dumb to count with one. He said, come down here. I said, what am I going to write about? He said, write about everything in that four steps that you refuse to tell anybody else. I said, I ain't going to do it. He said, wait a minute here. Your picture's been on 49 post offices in 49 states and unions, right and left face with your thumb and your fingerprint. And he said, who are you kidding? I said, yes, sir. And so I go down there. And I walk in there, he tells the secretary, cut the calls off. He looked at me and he said, did you do the first two parts of the fifth step before you come down? I said, what are you talking about? He said, did you admit to God, and then did you admit to yourself, and God admit you were wrong before you come in? I said, nobody does that. He says, you're going to do it. I said, you're crazy. He says, you're going to be crazy. Now go out and do it. I said, I ain't going to do it. He says, get out there, and I'm scared of my sponsor. I threatened if I saw him on the freeway, I'd run over him. I said, I'm not going to do it. He says, yes, you are. He says, there's a men's room in there. You go in there, and you lock the door, and then you go in the commode part, and you slide the bolt, and you admit to God the exact nature you're wrong. And then you unslide the boat and you come out, and above the sink there's a mirror. You look in there and you admit to yourself that that makes you wrong. And then you come in there and do it. Me, I said, nobody does it that way. He says, you're going to do it, and I don't. So I went in there and I locked the commode and door. And I felt like a fool when I went in the corner. I'm the only one in there. And so I admitted to God the exact nature of my wrongs, unslid the boat, come around, looked in the mirror above the sink, and I started admitting to me the exact nature of my wrongs. And guess what? I caught me not telling me what I told God the corner. I said, if I told God one thing, me one thing, what am I going to tell him? So I ran back in the corner and did it again. And I come back out and looked in the mirror, sounded reasonably the same. Even before I couldn't change it, I slid the boat and I run out there and I went in there. He said, you ready? I said, yeah. He said, cut the calls off. He said, how many times did you go in the corner? I said, two times. He said, I went three. He said, you see, now, David, I'm going to tell you something. He said, don't you go around Alcoholics Anonymous, spread all your dirt of into everything and everybody. He said, the next thing you know, he said, somebody's going to say, oh, you're not really that bad. And then you're going to run across somebody and say, you're not even really an alcoholic. You're not really. He says, now, God's here, you're here, I'm here, let it get out. The object is to get it out and not stuff it back in when you leave here. And then he said, get it out, and he did. When I got through, he says, how do you feel? I said, God, a great relief. He says, now, do you want me to tell you where to put it? And I said, yes, sir. He says, you go home, and you get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in the sixth chapter, into action, it's the only step in the book that tells you exactly what to do after you've done it. And he says, and if it takes you more than 10 minutes to take steps 6 and 7, then you have not been honest with me in your step. And so I went home. And I read what turned around my whole life. And I went home and I did what he told me, and I picked up the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read, it says, after we have taken this step, after we come home, we find a time where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. And we thank God from the bottom of our hearts that we know him better. Isn't that something? I wasn't thanking God that my sponsor knew me better. I wasn't thinking God that my wife and children would know me better. I wasn't thinking God that other people would know me better. I wasn't thinking God that I would know myself better. I was thanking God that I knew him better. And reaching up, I got the book down from the shelf and I turned to the pages containing 12 steps. And it says to read over the first 5 proposals. And then it asked me, have I omitted anything because I'm building an ark through which I will walk 3 man last. And it says, are the stones properly in place? Have we skimped on the cement put in the foundation? Have we tried to make martyrs without stones? And if we're satisfied,
then we can look at step six.
And I look at step six, and it says, willingness is indispensable. Are you now willing to have all of those things that are objectionable in your life removed, and God can do it?
And if you're not willing, you simply ask Him to make you willing that He do it. And here is the thing that turned around my life in the seventh step. When we're ready, it says in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous to us.
I didn't know how to pray when I came to you people, and my sponsor said there are three prayers in the big book, dummy, read them to him. And here's where I found the second prayer. And then we asked our Creator to take all of us, good and bad, to take it. And we pray that He will now remove from us every single defect of character which stands in the way of our usefulness to Him and our fellows, and grant us strength as we go forth and do His bidding. Amen. A very simple but powerful prayer. When I got to you people, little did I realize that my wife and two children boys would ever be on the roof again. And this is how it is today. That marriage had been written off by everything and everybody and had no right to be. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Al-Anon in my wife's life. As you heard this morning, and those who didn't, that beautiful and wonderful woman, we celebrated our 34th consecutive wedding anniversary this past June 10th, and that's pretty good for some. You see, it took a program in my life and a program in her life to do to and with and for us what we could not possibly do to and with and for ourselves. As Grace told you today, it's not perfect. You know, everything lovey-dovey all the time. We have a few short rounds every now and then. That's what's called clearing the air of communication. I can best describe our marriage today that it's built on solid, constructive imperfection. Because it's by our imperfections that we grow. Our two boys, my oldest boy, when he was 15 years of age, he put a butcher knife in my breast on one Sunday morning. He was going to kill me for what I was doing to their mother. And if I could have gotten off the floor, I'd have beat that boy to death. But then the wildness left his eyes, and he dropped the knife, and he turned around and he spat in my face, and he says, "You're no longer my father, and I'm no longer your son," and he walked out of my life, and that hurt. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, and only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and living a family life of what we call spiritual communication. What is spiritual living? Living the truth. As we are. With respect for each other's intelligence, and with respect as each other the freedom to make mistakes, and to love the kind of love that demands no reward. And today, I'll tell you, he's not only a fine young man, but something more important. We not only have a beautiful father-son relationship, but more important, we're the best of friends. And I'm going to tell you a little story that comes up about my youngster. He's the one that seemed to suffer more than anything. They couldn't bring their little kid home. They didn't know what situation I was in when I was drinking. November a year ago, he went down to the district attorney office of Dallas County to interview for a job. And he's down there interviewing. The district attorney says, "Wait a minute, Donald. 25 years ago this day, as you're here, I came to work for the then district attorney of Dallas County as an assistant prosecuting attorney. And God, I was full of vim and vigor, and I brought this little diary with me. And I wanted to write down everything that we discussed that day, so that my grandchildren and children and great-grandchildren and anyone that wanted it could have this diary. I want you to stop right this minute, and I want you to read to me what the first thing was that we discussed 25 years ago, this time today." Donnie opened it up, and the first thing on the agenda in that district attorney's office 25 years prior to that was what to do with one Dr. David H. Aronofsky. And Donnie looked up at him and he says, "Isn't sobriety and Alcoholics Anonymous the most wonderful thing in the world?" And the district attorney says, "Yes." And your daddy at that time, he said, "had not given us any trouble now and going on 9 years. And I almost missed it. And I had the same relationship with that youngest son that we do with the oldest one. And it's wonderful. When I got sober, the State Board of Dental Examiners were looking for me. And it served me with some papers to remove my license for the rest of my life. And they had the right to do it." Some sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous found out that I was going down to see him. And they said, "What are you going to tell them?" I said, "Well, I'm going to tell them I'm in AA. Unless I got, I deserve another." But they said, "No, you're not. You don't use Alcoholics Anonymous. to borrow any money. You don't use Alcoholics Anonymous for political favor. You don't use Alcoholics Anonymous for personal gain through publicity or anything else. Ours is a program of spiritual anonymity, not letting your right hand know what your left hand doing and what your right eye and your left eye is doing, but it's a feeling in there. And you ain't got that feeling. And you say, well, we don't tell you what to do. I said, what are you going to tell him? He said, go down and tell him what you did, not what you're going to do, because you don't know what you're going to do. You don't know whether you're going to be sober. You don't know where you're going to be, but you know what you did. I said, they already know it. He said, they want to hear it from you. I said, they said, do I have to? He said, if you won't stay sober. So I went down there, and I told them all these things are done, took everybody's money, didn't start their work, and work I did, I wouldn't have my own mouth. And that wasn't me saying it. And they started asking the questions. Just come back tomorrow. Finally, one of them says, what happened to you? Something different. I said, well, I fell in with a group of people. And they told me I couldn't stay sober unless I come down here and told you the truth. So what is it? I said, well, nobody's ever come. You're the only one come down here without a lawyer or nothing else. And something within me that wasn't me said, if there be fault, let it be mine. And what do I have to do? Yeah, we'll talk about it. And on the fifth day, he said, you have any equipment? I said, I have two pieces, but the sheriff is looking to repossess it. He said, I have a place to work. I said, no, but I think I can get one. He said, okay, go back to work. And we'll be checking up on you one day at a time. And 25 years ago, last May, one of the doctors that was and one of the examiners there said, well, that license over 10 and a half years ago, they gave my 25-year key of the American Dental Association in the last May the 10th. It was 30 consecutive years, and that's pretty good for a drug. You see, that's not me. This is all Alcoholics Anonymous. In the words of our co-founder Bill, ours is not a personal success story, but one of colossal human failure, converted into great strength by the alchemy of the living grace of God, as is expressed through the recovery program of Alcoholics Anonymous and our fellowship therein. So you see, only because of God's grace is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a sober life today. And only because of God's grace, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to, nor have I taken a drink of alcoholic nature since April the 20th of 1967, and for this I have to thank. And only because of God's grace, through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the miracle of the recovery program, I found a God of my very own. A God that I found through the 12 steps and through the big book and from nowhere else as a result of you people. And only because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have a wife and two sons that love and respect me. I have the best way to make a living I've ever had in my life. I've got a roof over my head. I've got a few dollars in my pocket in the bank. I've got two cars with gasoline in them. I've got a couple of these fancy new double-knit suits with vests. I've got meat in the refrigerator and groceries in the pantry, and I'll tell you a little secret. If you want anything any more than that, you either oversexed or plum nuts. And people such as you and A's, my group all over the world, have shown me that love and understanding are the keys to right principles and right attitudes and right actions, the keys to good living. This is a good way to live, not a life of goodness. But for David, a recovering sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, our 12 steps in their entirety, our 12 traditions in their entirety, our third legacy in its entirety, and our 12 concepts of world service in their entirety are the keys to the kind of life I'm having so much fun living and enjoying life today. I'd like to close now with a little story that's come very, very dear to me, and it sort of expresses how I feel. There's a little youngster that was an orphan, and he lived in the Midwest, and he had a terrible stuttering impairment. And every time he tried to talk, he'd start to stutter, and the youngsters used to tease him. And the harder he tried to talk, the worse it stuttered. And then he'd start to carry on, and he'd cry and he'd scream. And they made him perform. And the little youngster got to the point in his life to where he didn't like life anymore. He tried to kill himself by hanging himself in a chinaberry tree with his little belt, so they cut it down. And something happened to that little youngster. Something happened to him on the inside. And he'd walk and he'd go to classes and he'd go to eat with the rest of them and he'd go to sleep. And he'd just nod his head and he had a beautiful smile. And no matter how hard anybody tried to get him to talk, he wouldn't open up his mouth. As long as he didn't open his mouth and try to talk, he wouldn't stutter. But he walked around with this beautiful look in his eyes. And one Sunday morning, the visiting preacher didn't come and they didn't have anybody to read the devotional prayer. And so the superintendent called for a volunteer.
And little stuttering Johnny held his hand up, and the superintendent looked at him and said, "Johnny, are you sure you know what you're doing?" Johnny just nodded his head and said, "Well, come on." And as he walked up towards the lectern, all the youngsters started screaming out and catcalling, "There goes stuttering Johnny, there goes stuttering Johnny." And Johnny very calmly came up behind the lectern and opened up the prayer book and he began to read. And as he began to read, each word was perfectly enunciated. And each letter was perfectly, And each word was perfectly pronunciated. And as he began to read, there came from within outward a manner and a look, that look that I saw in Eva's eyes 27 years ago in that barbershop. A look that I saw in those AAs that were there to greet me on April the 21st when I come to my first AA meeting to take over in 1967. A look that I see in your eyes now. And I know now what I didn't recognize in Eve's eyes 27 years. That joyous, happy, dancing look. That look that God is doing for us. What we could not possibly do for ourselves. And as Johnny began to read, this look became more beautiful. And when he finished and said amen, there was a deathly pause. And after the services were over with, the superintendent ran up to little Johnny. And he put his arms around him and he kissed him on his forehead and he said, "Johnny, do you realize what you have just done? That you read those prayers perfectly. You did not stutter even once." And little Johnny was standing on his tiptoes and he was beaming from ear to ear. And he said, "Mr. Superintendent, when I read and when I talk to the God of my understanding, I do not stutter because he loves me. God bless each and every one of you, and I love you so much. I